It's the confluence where the news comes together. On 90.5 WESA, I'm Kevin Gavin. Randall Taylor is a community activist, a former member of the Pittsburgh School Board, and he's a candidate for the City Council District 9 seat currently held by three-term incumbent Reverend Ricky Burgess. Randall Taylor, welcome to the confluence.
Welcome, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
Great. Let's begin with the obvious question. Why? Why are you seeking this seat?
Wow. You know, it's really nothing I would have expected. I have not run for public office in a long, long time. But I was a resident of Penn Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
And that experience of not only what happened to me and 500 of my neighbors, but also the journey that we took into how that occurred, the role of city government, the role of our community development corporations, and just the whole experience of gentrification, of what that is, how that occurs, and how it affects people. And I felt it important to come out and to not only warn people, particularly in communities like Homewood, about the dangers, but to also talk about other communities that have experienced this and to tell them why this is happening and who are the forces that are behind this happening and what we can do to come together to prevent the future displacements, to prevent skyrocketing rents, prevent seniors being moved out of their houses because their taxes are going up. And so I want to share what I've learned with not only District 9 voters, but also with the city.
So was it that one big event, the moving people out of Penn Plaza, part of a new development, or was that the tipping point of other things that have been, you know, sort of maybe bothering you?
Oh, no. For me, I mean, Pittsburgh, I mean, I've remained an activist, and there's things I've always been involved with and issues that I've always, you know, helped with and candidates that I believed in that I would help. But again, running for public office, again, really wasn't anything that has certainly been on my radar screen for years.
Randall, do you think that the incumbent, Reverend Burgess, has come up short? And on what issues, if so?
Well, I mean, I honestly think that, you know, when you've run and you've never really been able to get the majority of people, you know, behind you. When I was on the school board, I think I enjoyed a great amount of support in my community. In many instances, I ran unopposed, you know, for the office. And but quite frankly, the housing issue, which we do have to talk about, and I hope I get an opportunity to talk about other issues as this campaign goes along, but I do understand why this housing issue is so critical and why it seems to be all the people really want to talk about. But the issue of the housing speaks for itself. I mean, the housing that we have right now is not enough. Again, the only people walking away really benefiting the most are private developers. The people are forced to rent forever. And that's the reason why we have to change in this city how housing is done. And one of the main things we have to do is begin to remove the profit out of housing.
So you're implying that Councilman Burgess is not doing enough for getting more affordable housing, or what?
I think this city and elected officials are committed to this current form of housing.
Okay.
And I don't think that they see or nor they want to consider alternatives and options. But you have to know that their way has failed. That's why we have 17 to 20,000 shortage of affordable housing. That's why we see rent going through the roof. That's why we see people being displaced, because it has failed and it has utterly failed. And that's the reason why we have to begin to do housing a different way.
All right. How different? What are the options? What do you see as an alternative?
Well, one of the first things we need to stop doing is building new. Building new is, these units are going into $300,000 a piece. You can rehab a house that's not gone too far for $100,000. For right now, again, we have to begin to talk about, again, taking the profit out of from the developers and the owners and landlords and begin to put that in the pockets of renters and homeowners. Now, we believe one of the ways to do that is to begin to explore tenant-owned cooperatives where people can actually own a part of that and have an ownership stake in their housing. So that $700 a month that they're spending is not going into the hand of a private developer or a landlord. It's going back into their pocket for something that they own. And though we don't have all the details, but we know that that is direction that we have to begin to go. We have to start talking about rehabbing properties out there. We have to start talking about putting money in the hands of homeowners who are barely holding on, who may have to walk away from the house because the roof just went. So these are things where you can begin to affect massive amounts of people in once. But these one little houses that they're building, I heard they talked about 600 new houses coming to Homewood over the next course of a few years. Okay, just say that's a family of four in each house. That's 2,400 people that are affected. Homewood has lost 15,000 to 20,000 over the last. So how are you going to put a dent in that many shortage of affordable units just building these one single house and not tackling like out in Homewood? There's just big apartment buildings that are sitting out there that could house 30 or 40 people at one time. That's what we got to start talking about, Kevin, how we get people in houses and how we can take the profit out of housing.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Randall Taylor, who is challenging incumbent City Councilor Ricky Burgess. District 9 includes all or part of East Hills, East Liberty, Friendship, Garfield, Homewood, Larimer, Lincoln Lemington, Belmar, Point Breeze North, and Stanton Heights. That's a fairly diverse district. So what is your approach to assessing the needs of the residents of all these neighborhoods?
Well,
they might be different needs.
Oh, and there certainly are different needs. And I certainly know from my 12 years on the Pittsburgh Board of Education that those are the areas. Again, the district represents when I was on the school board, it had the richest area of the town, which was South Point Breeze, and at the poorest part of town, places like Larimer and things like that. So you do have to assess the different needs. There are more severe needs around housing in other communities, but you have to do triage. You have to go to where the need is most critical. We do have issues in places like Homewood, and the very issues whether Homewood will survive as a historically African-American community. We have different issues in East Hills, more social things that people need. I'm very much just talking about supporting our young single mothers in places like East Hills. Point Breeze has been a historically diverse neighborhood that is absolutely bleeding African-American residents because they can't afford the rents. And then we have a concern with people in Point Breeze about the potential exploding of property taxes because we have older people, they just want to live there. They're not concerned about their house value going up to half a million. They're concerned about that tax bill. And so those are things we have to be concerned about. And Garfield is another area where we want to make sure that it's moving, but we have to want to make sure that people are able to afford to stay in those communities. So all those things have to be worked on. But I think we have a good chance to talk to people and be heard. But again, Kevin, we want to talk about a different way of doing things, different priorities in the city.
We elect our members of council by district. So I want to ask you, how do you weigh the needs of your district, of the District 9 residents, and where does that fit into the overall picture of the whole city?
Well, how the whole city is going to benefit from the investment in the Homewood, which we think is going to come anyway. The question is going to be, are the residents going to be driven out there and it be replaced with half a million? It looks like a new Mount Lebanon. And so we have to understand that once we do that right in Homewood, there's going to be a whole lot more tax money, you know, coming out of this, out of that area. But we mainly have to value our people here. I mean, we really honestly have to value our people and know that the answers to Pittsburgh aren't people coming from outside, that the answers are right here with these people here. Invest in them. Make sure that they're paid a decent wage. When they go to work for some of these places, what are we talking about, $15 an hour? We know nobody can live on that. So why aren't we talking about $17 an hour? Why aren't we looking for serious ways to invest in our people? And it really hurts me to see a place like Homewood, where you have, you know, young African-Americans in that community. And right up the street, we have Google, we have CMU exploding, and we don't have those partnerships to bring in, you know, those kind of people. There's so much opportunity in this city happening right now. Why are we talking about bringing new people in here when we have people right here who have all the talents and they have all the initiative? Just need a little bit of direction, you know, to get on the road that we want them on. And we're going to make this an even greater city, an example that the whole country can look at.
Right now, it's a very crowded field. Mm-hmm. Yourself, Ricky Burgess, Leon Ford, Cheryl Fuller, Judith Ginyard, and Kieran Young that we know of. Mm-hmm. Even if a couple of challengers pull out, how do you approach your campaign with multiple candidates on the ballot?
Well, I know one thing that we have to do is continue to talk about this message and to talk about our ideas. And we honestly think that these ideas are going to attract people, not only in District 9, but across this city. We're talking about serious reforms and how this city operates. We want to democratize this city more. Kevin, do people realize that our mayor of the city of Pittsburgh controls the housing authority, the water authority, the parking authority, the urban redevelopment authority? That's one man or woman that is deciding on their own. And it's simply not good for this city. It's simply not good for the city. We should term limit our mayor. We need to bring more democracy, more transparency, more openness to city government and city policy. And I do think that as we move along, that there's going to be a lot of people who are interested in that. Of course, it's a concern, you know, when you have a lot of people, but the people, I'm sure, feel just as passionate about this their community, you know, as I do. I can tell you it's fluid out there, so we'll have to see what things look like in the next few weeks.
Should we term limit city council members?
You know what? I mean, a term limit, I would probably say no, for the same reason why we don't term limit Congress, so some people would see that. There's a lot to be said about institutional knowledge and things like that. But an executive, you know, with the power of the presidency or the power of a governor, most executives are term limited in just about all parts of the country. We're probably one of the few in this country. I don't think Chicago does. I know Philadelphia does. The term limits their mayor.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the incumbent benefits from multiple challengers?
Well, as I said, I mean, I think it's a different race. I mean, I think if it was just any ordinary race and, you know, any ordinary beauty contest competition, of course an incumbent would always benefit from, you know, multiple challengers, because they're always going to have either a core group that's going to support them, and they're also going to have people who just maybe aren't following issues. I talked to a voter last time they ran. I voted for him. Why? Oh, he's the incumbent. He must be doing a good job. So there are some people. So sometimes a combination of that can, you know, get you. It won't get you majority, but it may get you enough in a multiple field to win. So as I said, Kevin, we're thinking, you know, I know, and people I'm working with and a group of people we're working with, we're aware of what people are saying. We're aware of the concerns. But we do know that the most important thing is that our councilman is not rehired. We do know that. And I think all those other candidates, we've talked. Believe me, we have talked and we continue to talk. But we have all made it clear among ourselves, we think that is paramount, that our councilman is not rehired.
Will you stay in it through the primary?
Well, I stay in it through the primary.
Yeah, I mean.
Right now, that is our plan. That is our plan right now.
Randall Taylor, community activist, former Pittsburgh School Board member, is a candidate in Pittsburgh City Council's District 9. Randall, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I enjoyed it very much.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Just ahead on The Confluence, PennDOT is facing a growing backlog of applications for real IDs. The first batch of identification cards is supposed to be issued tomorrow, but they're already struggling to find documents that should be there. Art pop super duo Princess is performing a new work this weekend. The artist described their show Out There as a sci-fi feminist rock opera. And the 38th annual Pittsburgh Home and Garden Show begins Friday at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center. This year's showcase includes a farm-to-table by local conference. These stories, conversations, and more when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
The winter of 1997 and 1998 had us all feeling a bit like icebergs, just unable to escape the draw of Titanic. Of course I'm talking about the blockbuster film and its signature song. My Heart Will Go On hit number one in the U.S. on this day in 1998. The soundtrack had been holding at number one since the end of January, and the film itself was in the top spot since the end of December.
Every night in my dreams, I see you, I feel you.
For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
What happens when environmental rules aren't enforced? This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Julie Grant. Democratic lawmakers are concerned about new numbers from the EPA. Data show significant drops in inspections, penalties, and criminal cases. Susan Bodine, Assistant Administrator of Enforcement and Compliance, defended the agency at a House committee hearing.
A strong enforcement program does not mean that we have to collect a particular dollar amount of penalties or take a particular number of formal actions.
Juliette Eilperin of the Washington Post has investigated the drop in EPA's enforcement of environmental regulations.
They would rather work with companies and try to fix things initially than crack down on them for violating the law.
We spoke with Alperin for our podcast, Trump on Earth. Okay, could we talk about the difference between civil penalties and criminal charges, intentional wrongdoing? There's one case that's gotten a lot of attention.
In August 1996, the owner of fertilizer company Evergreen Resources told his employees to clean out a 25,000-gallon tank, ignoring requests for safety equipment.
This is from an EPA video on criminal enforcement.
A 20-year-old man climbed down into the tank wearing nothing but jeans and a t-shirt. Paramedics removed Scott Dominguez from the tank and rushed him to the hospital, a victim of cyanide poisoning.
So that young man, Scott Dominguez, suffered severe brain damage in that incident.
Owner Alan Elias was sentenced to 17 years in prison for falsifying a safety plan and committing numerous hazardous waste violations that resulted in Scott's permanent, life-changing injuries.
Would you be able to give us some other examples of EPA criminal charges?
One incident that listeners might be familiar with is when there was a terrible coal ash spill in North Carolina on the Dan River several years ago.
3 weeks ago, a pipe that runs under a coal ash pond collapsed at a plant owned by Duke Energy Company. Coal ash is the waste produced.
What EPA was able to discover is that there had been folks within Duke Energy who had been warning that pipes were corroding and that they needed to be replaced or fixed in order to avert a disaster. That's criminal negligence.
And in those cases, those companies and the people who lead them are held to task criminally. They can wind up in prison.
Yes. And when you look at kind of the number of defendants that were charged, the number of years of incarceration, all of that has also declined. And there is a very clear connection to some extent about staffing that basically, for example, under a law that dates back a couple of decades, there's supposed to be at least 200 criminal special agents in pursuing these cases. And what we've seen is that number has declined significantly. Right now it stands at 147. So there simply aren't enough people working on criminal cases at the Environmental Protection Agency right now.
Do we have any evidence or examples at this point that the decreases at EPA are harming public health or the environment? I mean, is this trickling down at this point to the average person in America?
I think in terms of this specific issue of enforcement, most experts across the political spectrum would say that there will be ramifications from fewer inspections, fewer cases, things like that.
Juliet Alperin is a reporter with The Washington Post. There's more of our conversation at TrumpOnEarth.org. And that's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Julie Grant.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Out There is the title of a new video concept album with live music by the group Princess. As 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll reports, it's a lighthearted show about a serious issue.
If there's one thing two white guys don't want to do in 2019, it's mansplain feminism. Even, or maybe especially, if they're wearing skirts, unitards, and eyeliner while they're doing it. Princess is in on its own joke. The art pop duo consists of Alexis Gideon and Michael O'Neill. The two first performed together as Princess years ago, as young artists in Chicago. Gideon now lives in Pittsburgh, O'Neill in Brooklyn. Out There emerged from their long distance efforts to make music together again. That's Princess in rehearsal in Gideon's basement studio. The show lasts an hour and includes songs performed live alongside projected video. Gideon calls Out There a sci-fi feminist rock opera, partly inspired by concept albums like David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust.
The fictitious characters of Michael and myself, Princess, foolishly decide they're going to go and solve the problem of Earth being a misogynistic dystopia. And we follow them along their sort of trials and tribulations, and they hopefully learn a lesson by the end of it.
Gideon and O'Neill perform standing on either side of the screen, singing and playing keyboards and electric guitars live. Their videotape likenesses are animated stop-motion style, which makes them look like herky-jerky paper cutouts. The colors are vivid, and the feel is arch, campy, and even psychedelic as the characters blast off from Earth, get taken prisoner, and have other adventures. And the music is electropop stuff like this, mixed with Gideon's raps. Out There emphasizes the irony of two male artists booking a cross-country concert tour to deliver the message that men should listen to women, says O'Neill.
The farce of the piece is that we're two superhero-type men who think that we are the ones that can save the day, when actually the thing we have to learn how to do is not be so intensely active, to play a more support role in the world and with women in particular.
Complementing Gideon's visuals is hand-drawn art by Pittsburgh-based artist Jennifer Meridian.
It's interesting how Alexis is able to take a static image and make it come to life in all these different ways.
Other collaborators include J.D. Sampson of feminist electro-rock band La Tigre and indie rock band Teen. The show debuts Friday with one performance as part of the Andy Warhol Museum's sound series. Ben Harrison curates performances at the Warhol.
There's a kind of a punk sensibility to it and a kind of homemade sensibility, but yet the way it all comes together, it's really polished.
After the premiere here, Princess takes Out There on a 39-city tour. The New York City premiere is at the New Museum of Contemporary Art. Associate curator Sarah O'Keefe says she sees it as a novel way to address misogyny.
What's exciting about the project is it takes up these issues through science fiction and is really harkening back to some of the really seminal music videos.
Perhaps even more importantly, Gideon and O'Neill get it on women's issues, says artist Meridian.
I think the big takeaway for everyone is just to spend more time listening to women, people who identify as femme.
And that doesn't seem like such an out there idea after all. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
WESA receives funding from the Andy Warhol Museum. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Pennsylvania is all set to begin issuing millions of new driver's licenses. Real IDs will allow their holders to board commercial flights and enter certain secure facilities when the new standards take effect in the Commonwealth next year. The State Department of Transportation says the official rollout starts Friday, but there's a bit of a snag. More than 30,000 people are already waiting for the new IDs. Nicole Brambilla wrote about the backlog for Trib Total Media, and she joins us now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So PennDOT started pre-verifying cardholders last year. Why are they already so behind?
Last year, so you have to back up a little bit. In 2003 is when PennDOT started making digital copies of the documents when people bring in for their driver's license. And if you got a driver's license in Pennsylvania after that time, they probably have your documents. And that's what they were pre-verifying. Otherwise, you have to go down to the DMV with a birth certificate that has a raised seal on it, a Social Security card, two proofs of permanent resident, and also any name changes. You have to bring all of that to the DMV if you haven't gotten your license after 2003.
How long does that process take, do we know?
That's a very good question. PennDOT won't say. I personally went through the process being a new driver as of 2014 in Pennsylvania, and I just got a response this morning at 2 a.m. saying that they don't have my records on file. So now I have to bring all of them again down to the DMV.
So it sounds like an imperfect science. What is PennDOT doing that requires such a long lead time to get this done?
One of the things that they said, which makes sense, is that some of these older documents, like say if you went in 2003 or 4 or 5, that they copied on microfilm. And so it's a tedious process to go to retrieve them. But people who, like myself, went in the last couple of years and it should have been digitized, I'm not sure what the holdup is.
2003 is when they began to digitize, is that correct?
Well, 2003 is when they began to make copies of it. You've always had to go in with something to prove that who you are, and that would have been, a birth certificate. And then if you renewed all these years, then they never would have had it on file.
So say you're a new driver in Pittsburgh or an old driver in Pittsburgh. Where do you go now to make sure that you have these correct documents so that you can board your flights like you like to?
Well, you can go online if you think, like me, that you got your driver's license and you brought in all the stuff and they should have copies of it because it was after 2003. You can do that online through PennDOT and wait, hopefully not as long as I did, to get a response. Or you can bring all your documents into any DMV. And when you do that, then it's about a 15 business day wait, according to PennDOT, to get your real ID in the mail. Now, they don't start issuing them until March, which starts Friday.
Any DMV?
Any DMV. That doesn't mean that you're going to get same day service, though.
So how far along are they in the process right now?
Pretty close. I mean, they'll be issuing real IDs starting Friday, ostensibly.
Millions to do, but how many are actually done already?
Well, at this point, nobody has an actual real ID because they haven't started issuing them. What people have been getting is a letter from PennDOT saying, yes, we have your records on file if you did it online like I did. Or people have, since September of last year, been able to bring in their documents to DMV. They scan them in, and then you can skip the line and get verified, and then you can do the process online. Does that make sense?
Clear as mud. You're new to Pittsburgh, but you've been reporting on this issue for years. How did Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh get in this mess to begin with?
That's a fantastic question. In our lawmakers' wisdom in 2005, we opted out of Real ID, and they passed a law that said that Pennsylvania as a commonwealth will not participate in Real ID. And for years, for some reason, inexplicably, Department of Homeland Security has been giving Pennsylvania extensions to comply, even though the state said they're not going to comply. And that stopped in the fall of 2016. And all of a sudden, Pennsylvania was left scrambling to try to, one, repeal the law and then put Real ID in motion. And that happened in 2017. The governor signed something in June of 2017.
So now it's a priority?
Now it's a priority. Because Pennsylvanians weren't going to be able to get on domestic flights.
Is there more PennDOT should be doing at this point to encourage residents to apply, or would that make the backlog worse?
I mean, we're scrambling now because of what lawmakers did in 2005. The other thing is that people obviously are procrastinating with only 300,000 people asking to pre-verify when PennDOT expects 2.5 million people to be seeking an ID. We're procrastinating. But that has ramifications down the line because with only about a dozen additional centers being put in place to handle Real ID, you can expect long lines. I'd be surprised if there's not long lines.
So responsible Pennsylvanians should get their paperwork in quickly. If you don't and you find yourself needing to take a flight, what's the recourse? What can you do?
My own experience is the online pre-verification took me 6 months, and then they didn't have my documents after all. So you take your chances, but I would, if you're going to fly at all at any time in 2020, I would start the process now. And it might be quicker to get a passport.
Nicole Brambilla is a reporter for Trip Total Media. Nicole, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The 38th Annual Pittsburgh Home and Garden Show kicks off tomorrow at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center. Over the years, it's grown tremendously and now the largest home event in North America. Joining us in studio is the person who's been the executive director since its inception, John DeSantis. Welcome to The Confluence.
It's great to be here, Kevin. Thank you.
So I understand the first show featured about 133 vendors. This year, more than 1,800.
That's right.
All right, fess up. Did you ever think it could grow to this state?
Well, you don't think about that at the beginning, of course, but I think that the important thing from the beginning was that we focused on making sure that for people who were interested in their home, whether they were in an apartment or a house, whatever the situation was, we wanted to provide what they were looking for. And so we started off providing a small amount of what they were looking for. And today, we just have this endless sea of what they're looking for. But no, at the beginning, you wouldn't envision that, I don't think.
Right. I assume residents of larger cities are also interested in home and garden exhibitions, fixing up their homes, adding to their gardens. So why does Pittsburgh have the largest home event?
You know, it's an answer that when you hear it, you're going to just nod your head and say, oh, yeah. the big cities, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, don't have big home and garden shows. And people there are, of course, interested in their homes and such, but they tend not to spend as much time in and around their home as we do here in Western Pennsylvania. Pittsburghers and the folks surrounding this area are very traditional. We actually spend a lot of time at home. And as a result, we pay attention to what's going on. We want it to be nice for ourselves, for our families, for our friends. And there are so many Pittsburghers here who have been in their homes literally their entire lives. The national average, Kevin, is that people move in America once every 4 years. What do you think the number is in Pittsburgh?
Once every 12.
You're very close, 11.
Oh.
11 years. It's almost three times the national average. And of course, in Pittsburgh, lots of us know people who are living in the home that they grew up in as kids.
Right. Do you get feedback from your visitors? You know, like, I'd really like to see this next year.
Absolutely. In fact, it's one of the questions that we ask that's most important. We survey our visitors continually during the show and have for more than 25 years. And the most important question to us is, what did you like at the show? And the next question that we really think matters is, what would you like to see? Was there something you were looking for? And what we typically hear, the typical answer to that question is, gee, I can't think of anything I didn't see, which is a great answer for us to hear.
Has part of the success been that there's a mix, shall we say, of luxury items, but as well as the necessities?
Well, that's absolutely incredible that you mentioned that, because that's one of the pieces of feedback that we get most often is people come who've never been there and they say, you know, I kind of was expecting that I was going to see all this expensive stuff that I couldn't afford or that I really didn't have any use for. And I saw that all of the normal things that I really do use or would like to have are also here. Even in, within the same exhibit, you'll see many different things. You'll see kind of the beginner's level, the mid-level, and the knock-your-socks-off level. And that's important for the exhibitors as well, because they recognize that some people are looking for one end of the spectrum and some are looking for the other.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. There's always something new at the Home and Garden Show. This year there is something new, but also very familiar. It's the 13th annual Farm to Table by Local Conference. It's part of the Home and Garden Show this year. I caught up with Erin Hart, Executive Director of Farm to Table Western PA, earlier while she was preparing for the show, and I asked her if this was a natural partnership, Farm to Table and Home and Garden.
It always has had some overlap in terms of vendors and audience, but we've been such a small event compared to this huge regional presence. And, you know, we thought it would be really helpful for the farms that we work with to be able to reach a mainstream audience and be able to market their products that they grow. It just gives them a nice introduction to meet a farmer one-on-one.
So what sort of local vendors are we talking about? Give us a range of the types of food producers.
Well, I mean, there's always honey and maple syrup. So that's, you know, two vendor categories that will be there. And then we have a lot of farms that make value-added products. So there's Conover Organic Farm out in Burgettstown. They grow their own organic produce, and then they can it. So they make things like dilly beans and jellies and jams and even kimchi. There's Kefir Water, the Kefir Chicks, they're coming. Weatherberry Farm, they grow a lot of grains, but they also sell beef. And then everything in between. So, you know, a lot of produce farms will be talking about their CSA subscriptions that people can subscribe to a local farm. It stands for Community Supported Agriculture. And they typically start in early June. So this is the time of year when people can start talking to farms, and you can add in not just produce, but eggs and meat and other products as well.
Right. Pittsburghers, they're getting the itch to get their gardens going and growing. I understand there'll be some gardening tips as well.
Absolutely. We have some speakers from Grow Pittsburgh are coming. Penn State Extension and Master Gardener program with the Pennsylvania Women's Agricultural Network. They're doing some talks about growing. There's some container gardening, straw bale gardening.
You know, I was not familiar with straw bale gardening. How does that work?
Well, they have a straw bale, I mean, if you can imagine.
Right.
And then they cut a hole in the center. And because it's organic material, the whole structure just kind of sort of melt into the yard. So it, you know, it doesn't need to go anywhere because it just breaks down over time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a natural container.
Are more Pittsburghers raising their own chickens? And just curious, will there be any advice demonstrations on chicken raising?
We do have, we have a talk that's called Chicken 101, Chickens 101. And it's from an organization called Rent the Chicken, where they actually can, you know, they can help you get all set up to have your own chickens and have your own hens that are laying eggs. So, I mean, there are a lot of people out there who have chickens. And if you live in the city, you might not realize it. You know, it seems like an urban agriculture kind of thing, but this is happening in our region all the time.
That is Aaron Hart of Farm to Table. Remaining with us in the studio is John DeSantis, Executive Director of the Home and Garden Show. John, why do you think Farm to Table is a good fit for Home and Garden Show?
Oh, Kevin, we have so many people who attend the Home and Garden Show every year who are foodies, mm-hmm. and who are concerned about how their food is being sourced, who want to support local farming, and we're delighted to have Farm to Table with us. You know, Aaron was mentioning some of the presentations. There are two complete stage areas just within Farm to Table, independent from the other stage areas at the Home and Garden Show, with continuous performance schedules. I would encourage people who are considering coming to the show, if they have an interest even remotely in food, and I think pretty much everybody does, check the show website for those stage schedules. It's pghome.com, and all of those stage schedules, if you're coming and you're going to plan to see that, you're going to want to plan to be there on the right day.
I understand there's also chicken races.
Chicken racing. When you were saying chicken raising, I'm thinking, oh, Aaron must have laughed because there are also chicken races.
Oh my.
It's fun, it's great. It's an important message, by the way, for the next generation to pick up, that you want to support local farming, you want to eat fresh, and you want to buy local.
All right, so you're expanding, you're adding Farm to Table this year. We mentioned the largest home event in North America. Can you continue to grow? Is there room for you to grow?
We will always grow. You know, the Pittsburgh Convention Center is a superb building. I consider it the best convention center in the country. And it has been designed to be flexible space. So we will always want to add what's important and new. And we're delighted to be able to do that. This year alone, we've added more than 200 new exhibits to the show.
So the logical question, what event exhibition are you most excited about?
At the show?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the thing that's most exciting to me at the show is Children's Village.
Oh.
Because it's a long-standing tradition, more than 30 years at the show. And we have people who are bringing their children to Children's Village who then tell us, I remember coming here when I was her age. And that's so wonderful. It is definitely the kind of place, not only is it okay to bring the kids, you want to bring the kids. And give yourself plenty of time. It's an enormous event. Plan to spend the day.
And I must say, how are you able to keep things exciting every year? I mean, people come back year after year, don't
they? That's the fun part. The fun part is knowing that next year they're going to expect it to be even better. Right. That makes a difference.
Well, but they come multiple times during the show.
Well, you know, what we've done this year is made it possible for people to have free re-entry once they've come one time. So you come to the show any day of the show, buy your ticket one time, and then before you leave the building, stop and get your free re-entry ticket, and you can come back any other day of the show without paying. And when you leave that day, you can stop and get another one. So you could literally come tomorrow on opening day, buy one ticket one time, and come every day for 10 days to the Home and Garden Show without paying again.
In just a couple of sentences, how important is it not just to have the exhibitions and the exhibits and the products, but also that advice from experts?
This is the place that you meet those people. All of the experts are here. If you have a question, if you have a project that you're not sure how to approach, if you just want more information about it, whether it's when you're cooking in the kitchen or when you're building an entire new house and everything in between, for 10 days, all of the experts, all of the products are inside the convention center downtown. It's why you don't want to miss that.
John DeSantis is the executive director of the Pittsburgh Home and Garden Show, which begins tomorrow and runs through March 10th at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center. John, thanks so much for coming in.
Pleasure being here, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Tomorrow at this time, a special, how public school districts are grappling with the need for translation and interpretation services for students and their families. The Confluence returns Monday. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stanelli, Joya Zenkovic, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.